Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Precious Chatterjee Duty, a lecturer in politics and international studies at Open University in the UK, and an expert on Russian foreign and security policy, as well as Russia's information politics and propaganda. She is the co-author of a new book published last year entitled Russia Today and Conspiracy Theories, People, Power, Politics on RT. Welcome, Precious, and thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
All right, it's great to have you, first-time guest. Now, the first thing I'd like to ask you is the continuing and, I would say, intensifying Russian state campaign to suppress dissent, the clampdown on political opposition, civil society, and independent media, and pretty much any independent voices. There continue to be many developments in this area, including the treatment of Alexei Navalny in prison, the long prison sentence for opposition politician Ilya Yashin, and the jailing of American journalist Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal on espionage charges that his newspaper and the United States firmly deny. But the one development that obviously jumps out today and will for a long time to come, of course, is the trial and the verdict in the trial of Vladimir Kara-Murza, an opposition politician and a vocal advocate for international sanctions against Russian officials who violate human rights. Kara-Murza was charged with treason. He spends a lot of time in the United States, but he returned to Russia last year after giving a particularly a speech in which he condemned essentially Russia for the invasion of Ukraine in the United States. But he returned after that and was quickly arrested, and charges began to he's been charged with three separate crimes, including treason. And today he was convicted by a Moscow court and sentenced to 25 years in prison, which is the term that the state prosecutors had asked for in his case. I actually think it's fairly unusual for the court. I mean, these trials are politically charged trials in Russia. You know, tend to be, choreographed, at least many would say that, and I think it's true. But I think it's rare for the court to pronounce the sentence that is recommended by prosecutors. Usually they cut a little bit off. But in this case, 25 years in prison for Vladimir Kara-Murza. And there's been a large international outcry already, in the hours after this verdict and sentence were pronounced. I'll just a previous quote from Human Rights Watch. That organization said that Kara-Murza was facing a, quote, monstrous prison term for no more than raising his voice and elevating the voices of others in Russia who disagree with the Kremlin, its war in Ukraine, and its escalating repression within Russia. So, Precious, my question is, what kind of a signal is Russia, is Moscow, is the government sending with the prosecution of Vladimir Kara-Murza and the conviction and this 25-year prison sentence for Kara-Murza?
Thanks very much. It's a really good question, and it's an important one, really, because I think, as we're all aware, there has been this, ramping up of restrictions on the media in general, and obviously on war reporting in particular. very high-profile laws prohibiting the discrediting of the armed forces and the spreading of false information, which in effect is just any information that contradicts the official Russian position. But, you know, as you alluded to, the reason that the sentencing term is so long in this case is because it's essentially being passed off as treason. And, you know, for me, what's interesting here is not just that we've seen a sort of selective application of these various restrictions over time. So you look back to a year ago when the context was a bit different. We had Marina Ovsyannikova's on-screen protest at Channel One, which, you know, she was only fined for, you know, subsequent protests. After that, she was looking at a prison sentence until she fled to France. We've had other cases, you know, the jailing of Evan Gershkovitz of the Wall Street Journal, the case of Alexei Moskalyov, who's facing time in prison due to his daughter doing anti-war drawings. You know, if you're looking at the broader picture, it is this, not necessarily just the ramping up of restrictions, but the more active policing of them, you know, actually putting into practice the kind of maximum responses that are possible underneath the restrictions as they stand. Now, in Karamurza's case, I think basically it's his international profile and work that mean that the Kremlin really do see him as a threat. You know, he's not just involved in oppositional politics, but, you know, he's a journalist, human rights activist, and he's been very outspoken on the war with significant sort of international ramifications. You know, he does have a significant international profile. So in that respect, he kind of described it himself last week as being a Stalinist type show trial. And I think that's exactly what it is. The idea behind this kind of maximum penalty is basically part of a wider campaign to convince the broader Russian population that it's just not worth the risk of either speaking out individually or organising more generally. And I think that's a good way to kind of characterise all these more recent moves to really stamp down on any sort of expressions of dissent. You know, as you already alluded to, the international response to this has been pretty quick. In the case of the UK, you know, bearing in mind he has dual citizenship, the UK immediately summoned the Russian ambassador, has called this out straight away as being a politically motivated conviction. You know, as it happens, the presiding judge was already under UK sanctions since, I think, 2020 with the campaign of sanctions relating to the death of Sergei Magnitsky. And British embassy officials have, you know, been attending all the various court hearings. So this is something that's been, you know, kind of on the international radar for a long time, but I think it speaks to this broader fear, basically, and this broader kind of this unrest within the Kremlin that any clear, impactful or outspoken response to the war, any criticism of the war that can resonate more broadly, can have quite serious ramifications. I think a big part of their tactics to date have been to sort of not necessarily to stamp down on unrest, but to curtail the expressions of unrest, because if people can't actively or effectively express how they're feeling, then it's a lot more difficult to stimulate a sort of broader social movement to kind of concretize those horizontal ties that would be necessary for any sort of actual resistance to what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of the signal to Russians, you know, clearly 25 years, you know, I think it's an unprecedented prison term for a Kremlin opponent, essentially. There are people who have been, including a journalist convicted of treason, who have received, I think Ivan Safronov received a 22-year prison term on treason charges that he and backers said were fabricated or untrue. But 25 years, I mean, others have gotten, Alexei Navalny's serving, I think, a 9-year and a 2.5-year term. Ilya Yashin, an opposition politician who was a deputy lawmaker in Moscow, received, I believe, an 8.5-year term last year. 25 years, you know, and as you say, they're choosing to treat this as treason. 25 years is unprecedented for for an opponent of the Kremlin, in the post-Soviet era. I just wanted to follow up with a question about you mentioned sort of that Karamurza has, he's made waves. He's had his activism and in support, in particular, of the Magnitsky Act in the U.S. and in other countries, including Britain, sanctions against Russians officials and others who are deemed to be involved in corruption and human rights abuses in Russia. He had advocated for that in those countries, particularly in the U.S. Do you think that, and he was a friend and associate of John McCain, senator in the U.S. Do you think the fact that he sort of has these U.S. ties is significant in the way that they've decided to punish him, maybe even in part kind of as a way for the Kremlin to say to kind of try to augment this argument that Russia's facing, not fighting a war of aggression against Ukraine, but is facing kind of a war essentially instigated by the United States and NATO.
Yeah, I think that's actually very important. And if you look back through history, and certainly, I'm not just talking about in the kind of Putin era, but prior to that as well, there is a very long tradition within Russia and previously within the Soviet Union of ruling elites using conspiracy theories to basically bolster their own positions in power. Now, often these are manifested in very similar ways, and often it will be the idea that the US is the kind of key global rival, if not enemy, and that there are ties between the US and kind of homegrown dissidents or oppositionalists that basically, they amount to treason. And so, we've seen that in things like foreign agent laws. We've seen that in the way that this case has been, played essentially as treason, because it's very easy to do that if you can point to overseas links. Now, very often these overseas links are used essentially to delegitimize any sort of oppositional sentiments. And we've heard this time and time again in recent years as well, the idea that any sort of grassroots social organization has been instigated by foreign provocateurs. We had those kind of explanations for the colour revolutions. We heard those kind of explanations from the Russian political elite for what happened in Ukraine in 2014. And so 2013, 2014. And so I think it plays into this broader narrative that has some sort of, some sort of precedent, some sort of resonance that suggests that, nefarious overseas powers are interfering directly in what's going on at home in Russia, and that these oppositionalists are basically stooges of the West. So I do think that's quite an important factor when you come to consider the severity with which this case has been treated. But in general, I would say it is absolute theatre. It is all about the optics of what's going on. It is about sending a signal. And I think a lot of these sort of escalatory, if you like, measures, in the past few couple of weeks, couple of months, they've been very much, it's almost played, with that in mind, with the idea of how it looks, how significant it looks, of keeping that facade, I suppose, that, actually we are under attack from all angles. This war is essentially, like a proxy war where the West is provoking our response. It's not Russian imperial aggression. Actually, it's part of a broader geopolitical picture. And unfortunately, when cases like this are heard, it's almost like even the specifics of the case, even the specifics of the person, they are almost secondary to the broader narratives that the Kremlin's seeking to tap into in how it plays what's going on, both within the kind of domestic sphere, within the war itself, and then in the broader international context, I think.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's very astute. I'd say also on a kind of a crude level of propaganda. Karamurza presumably is a kind of a fat target. Russians from, I guess, Putin and maybe Patrushev on down have been talking about, have been going on about Anglo-Saxons being the enemy. And this is a big theme on, as you know, on Russian TV. And Karamurza, you know, has links to Britain. He went to Cambridge, I believe, and of course to the United States. So I think he fits well as a target, into that narrative as well. But my second question, to move on, it's more directly about Russia's war against Ukraine. I'm going to focus on two developments. One is the law signed by Putin on Friday, I believe it was, allowing for digital draft notices. In other words, in the past, Russians were informed that they were being conscripted by, I believe, Telegram. You had to actually receive a written notice for it to be real. But now, under this new law, it's enough that you will have been sent a digital notice. It makes it harder to avoid conscription. And this has raised fears. And there's some other new restrictions as well, but this has raised fears of a new large-scale military co-op and is expected to make it harder for Russians to avoid being sent to the front. And this comes after, in September, Putin announced a mobilization, what he called a partial mobilization, but they sought to get and said they did bring almost, I think, 300,000 people, men mostly, to be potentially sent to the front. Now, this is one of many factors, I would say, that seem to suggest Putin is in this war for the long haul, and that it may continue for a long time despite substantial Russian setbacks. On the other hand, the Wagner mercenary group founder Yevgeny Prigozhin apparently said this weekend that what Russia should do now is essentially wind down the war and declare victory. At least as I read it, he's saying that Russia should stop trying to advance, which isn't going very well, and instead focus on holding the territory in Ukraine that it now controls, including a land corridor in southern Ukraine linking Russia with Crimea, which of course Russia seized control of in 2014. And while Prigozhin never criticizes Putin himself, limiting his salvos to lesser targets such as the defense ministry, he warned that people, in this case, he warned that people are looking for scapegoats, raising the specter of political problems for the government if the war goes on much longer. Now, Precious, I'm not asking you to make predictions about the further course of the war, but I'd be interested in your interpretation of these developments or any others you see as important at this point.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think for me, there's a really bitter irony in the way that these call-up notices are going to be going through the state services portal, because actually this portal itself had genuinely been seen as one of the kind of positive things that the Kremlin had achieved for its citizens in recent years, carving through Russia's pretty famous bureaucracy and creating genuine day-to-day benefits for its citizens. And for me, it's not just a bitter irony, but also a really stark illustration of how the Russian state works, that this genuinely positive achievement for Russian citizens has been just flipped on its head to benefit the state again. And the people are essentially, obviously, just another resource for the state, basically. So on the face of it, this makes the process of mobilization much quicker, cleaner, more effective. It kind of streamlines the pipeline, I guess, of soldiers to the front. And in reality, it could do that. It certainly makes it possible. But as with anything in the Russian context, in the contemporary Russian context, there is always a sort of balance to be struck between capacity and fulfillment. And if you think about Russia's war efforts so far, the whole thing has been a sort of balancing act between feeding the front and not provoking too much resistance at home. Now, resistance that can be easily squashed is, and we've seen examples of, you know, some of the further flung regions where protest amongst this, a protest about the mobilisation broke out, they've basically been drafted en masse, which sort of solves that problem in a way. But rather than squashing all the time, what happens is often the avoidance of big problems, big social problems. So that's why there have been some, you know, substantial, I guess, carve outs in terms of military service. You know, it's not too difficult to bribe your way out of that service if you need to. And the Kremlin essentially looks the other way, because if enough people can avoid doing the things they don't want to do, then it means you don't have to then deal with a kind of mass resistance problem. So the capacity to do something is not the same as seeing it through. And for tactical reasons, the Kremlin often does not see through to full capacity what it could do. And that's what we have to be looking at next, is the extent to which the capacity to call up significant numbers and then to, you know, prosecute if they avoid the draft, whether that's followed through. Because, you know, theoretically, the notice is sent, it's considered as received, and then there's basically a 7-day window, I believe, after which traveling abroad becomes illegal. Any sort of avoidance of that draft becomes illegal. But obviously, there are certain sectors of the population that will still be able to avoid the draft, will still be able to very rapidly leave the country. And those sections of the population are exactly the ones who were better able to avoid the draft before. So it becomes another episode in that general Russian story of basically placing the onus on the kind of weakest or least supported members of society and creating carve outs for those who are in a slightly more privileged position. And we'll have to see whether it does kind of play out in that way, but it is certainly possible, because that's to date how the Kremlin has sort of managed to some extent its dissatisfaction. So there's, you know, the opportunity to use this. How it will be used, I think, is an open question as yet. Thinking of Prigozhin's comments, essentially from a tactical point of view, what he said makes perfect sense. You know, if you wanted to cement your position, if as Russia you wanted to cement your position, then it makes sense not to overextend, to try and solidify those gains on the ground, to really insist on some specific but limited red lines. The thing is, what we've seen so far is that the Kremlin has not necessarily been willing to pursue courses of action that seem the most strategically sensible on the ground. It's not just a matter of what's going on in the conflict itself. There are all these other sort of domestic aspects, I think, that have to be taken into account. There are sort of legacy issues as well. There's power play at home, and there's power play abroad as well, I think, and the sort of management of the sort of international image of Russia and of Putin himself, in fact, which means that it's not just a case of following a sort of strategically sensible line. And I think, again, that's one of the other things that we have to consider. That's part of the way that the war has so far unfolded, has been in a very responsive way managing particular problems as they've arisen, that perhaps if there had been more strategic foresight would not have arisen in that way. And I think it does sort of speak to a pretty clear lack of proper cooperation, proper coordination between the various parties involved, and the power play between those parties. Obviously, Prigozhin himself has his own power base, I guess, through Wagner. It's a significant figure in his own right, and I guess then gets some sort of shielding to be able to say what he thinks, as long as he doesn't cross that magic red line of criticising Putin directly. And again, that's something that he and others are very aware of, is where the borders of allowable dissent lie. Those borders may shift over time, depending on how dissatisfied different portions of the elite become. And again, if you watch how those comments are made and where those lines shift to, that also gives an indication of that kind of intra-elite dynamics at work.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting to point out that, you know, to me, it seems like while on the surface saying, okay, we're going too far, we got to cut back on our goals, you know, would seem to be very much, you know, against what Putin has been suggesting. And but on the other hand, I suppose Putin could use that if he did want to kind of scale down. I don't know. It's hard to say. But also, I think you sort of mentioned both in your comments on Prigozhin. Very interesting. You kind of went back to the idea of, you know, how the elite interprets these things, and a big question, as you mentioned, is whether this new kind of e-mobilization or digital draft, whether it will actually be kind of enforced, whether it will actually be carried out. And very, very, you know, very good to point out that this is, there are a lot of things that the Russian government has said, you know, not just during the war, but in the years and decades before the invasion, that are not carried out. How many times has Putin talked about fighting corruption and that sort of thing? And, you know, okay, this time it's really gonna get, you know, really gonna cut deep and get to the elites. But, you know, as you say, we don't know. So we'll see whether those people who have been able to avoid the draft or have been kind of exempt, or as you mentioned, cutouts, whether they will now be included and be unable to do so, you know, that may have a significant effect on, you know, and I guess how people in the elite are interpreting what Putin is doing and saying.
Yeah, and just on that, there's a couple of other things I'd point out, which is, first of all, sometimes we see the Kremlin create this kind of capacity and not use it immediately, but then bring it into play later on. So we've seen that with things like reporting restrictions over the years. No, I don't just mean in the context of the full-scale invasion, but I mean sort of a longer-tailed trend where there have been, you know, kind of more restrictive laws and regulations, but again, only selectively applied until they felt it necessary to apply them more stringently. And then, together with more stringent application, we've had increasingly repressive laws instituted as well. So that's one thing, is that, you know, this could be architecture that might not necessarily come into play straight away, but may come into play later on. The second thing as well is that we've already seen instances of kind of responses to public dissent about particular sections of society being able to get away without being drafted. And we've seen responses to this in terms of, you know, elite members of the elite's families being drafted into units far, far, far from the front. So this kind of PR drafting process as well. Again, I don't think that's going to suddenly stop just because of this electronic mobilization. So there are various sleights of hand, I suppose, that can still be undertaken to make it look like a more generalized and more efficient mobilization process that don't necessarily get to the roots of the inequalities that underlie it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Very fascinating in a way, I suppose. You know, it could be a sham from the start, just kind of a to show less fortunate, I guess, you know, members of society that everyone's equal, everyone's going to get drafted. Whereas, you know, as you say, maybe this capacity will not be used or will not be used right away. Okay, well, thanks very much. Very, very incisive comments. We're getting short on time, but we have time for a couple questions, if there are any. So I will open it up to questions.
Hi, Charles Ray, you can ask your question.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Precious. My question is about the timing of this new law and whether you believe this is something that has been in the works for many months to make mobilization and conscription more efficient, or whether this is something more immediate in terms of a manpower shortage within the Russian military. What do you think about that?
Hi, Charles. Thanks for your question. I think it's impossible to tell for sure, to be honest. I think it's something that's probably been on the radar for some time, because when you think about the practicalities of it, obviously this makes a lot more sense than your standard paper draft notices. The fact that it was rushed through so quickly, it could be in response to difficulties at the front, but I think a lot of this is in fact theatre. You know, you rush things through, it looks very active, and sometimes it's that sort of like a perception of momentum almost to make it seem like, we are actively prosecuting the war in the most efficient way. And I think there are certain sort of, I don't want to say PR exactly, but there's a certain optics to it that I think is quite important rather than just being a practical matter on the ground. So I think that's a large part of it. And as I say, it remains to be seen the extent to which this will unfold to have practical ramifications straight away or not. I suspect, although I hate to kind of make predictions on the record, but I suspect we won't see a massive difference straight away. We're still going to see the same sort of patterning of drafting, despite this switch to the electronic call-up notices. But you can call me out on that if I turn out to be wrong.
Thanks very much, Precious. We will have time for another question if anyone has any. Let's give it a few more moments. While we wait, meanwhile,
I think Charles has a follow-up question.
Okay, go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't want to ask all the questions, but this discussion was very interesting. I guess I would like to ask, in terms of this mobilization effort and the electronic conscription and so on, I think that we have seen the damage to the Russian economy due to the reaction to the first mobilization. Is this somehow kind of a lessons learned from the Russian government? Is this some kind of way to protect, their economic stability, to set the stage for future mobilizations? I guess I would ask. I know that's kind of the same question as I asked before, but looking at it from an economic standpoint.
I think, again, there are similar. So we know that there was pretty dramatic and almost instant ramifications from the initial announcement about partial mobilization. The problem is, even with, it makes it harder, I think, to dodge a draft notice if this is used in the way it's intended to be used or is set up to be used. Intention obviously is a slightly different thing, but nonetheless, it is still possible absolutely to flee as long as you do it straight away. And again, it is essentially the kind of middle class that's going to be able to do that, which is the exact same contingent that they had the problem with before. So I don't think it particularly would solve that problem. Perhaps there's a perception that it will make it slightly harder to flee in that kind of brief period, but no, I honestly don't think that in a practical sense it will make much difference to that. I think it's exactly the same people who are still going to be able to avoid the call-up and exactly the same people who won't. What I do think this shows, though, as I said before, it's not just a bitter irony, but it's a really clear kind of illustration of how the state works, that essentially it kind of can switch something that was genuinely very useful for its citizens into something that can occasion the most harm on its citizens. But I do think, just the the nonsense of it. You know, we're talking about it in practical terms, but ultimately this is really nonsensical because there's absolutely no guarantee that anyone who has been sent a notice will have seen the notice. And we're almost glancing over that. You know, it is fundamentally flawed from a practical perspective. And I think that's almost part of the logic of it, that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that people genuinely might not have seen these draft notices. It is very much a very visual illustration of the absolute power of the state. And when I said earlier that I think a lot of this is about theatre, I think that's part of it, that this is, it's the state doing what the state does, and it doesn't matter whether it works on a practical level or not. It is just clear that we are on a war footing, and this is how we want to do it. The people are a resource for the state. And in that way, I think it repeats a very common story of Russian history, certainly a very common story of Russian military history. And to me, it's just, you know, very bitter and very sad that we're seeing this kind of same thing replayed, but using modern technologies.
Thanks so much. I just wanted, I thought that was a great, the people are the resource of the state. You know, that is encapsulates, you know, the continuing situation in Russia that may have changed for a few years in the 90s, but was back soon after Putin came to power, in my view. And as you say, I mean, it's a bitter irony. You know, anyone who spent time in the Soviet Union or post-Soviet Russia, you know, the bureaucracy and the inefficiencies, you know, going to Sberbank was a huge part of life. And this, you know, this system, you know, something that made things easier. And as you say, you know, it's a bitter irony that it's used to further again this idea that, you know, that the people are the resource of the state. So just wanted to, it was really running short on time, but if there's another question, we can take one. Okay. I don't see any others, so I'll see if Charles wants to follow up with the third question.
Yeah, really sorry, Steve. And Precious, but your answers are absolutely fantastic. So I'm just going to ask one more, which is, you know, essentially we're always talking about, you know, what is the straw that breaks the camel's back in Russian civic society, excuse me, in terms of, you know, when is that social contract broken, whether it be with the elites or with the middle class or with rural populations and so on. How do you see this conscription change and also, of course, the attrition rates, which are getting back into Russian public media? I know it's impossible to ask, like, when does that break, but what are the breaking points?
Yeah, great question. I think it is absolutely, it's about where that balance level is. And, you know, theoretically, like I said, in theory and practice is totally different. Theoretically, shifting these draft notices online, if they were to be uniformly applied, then that could be it, right? If people who have managed to pretend the war's not happening suddenly can't, that could be it. Is it going to be it? Honestly, I would say probably not at this stage, because I do believe that this has been quite clearly strategized by the Kremlin in the way that everything else has been so far, which is you squash the dissent that you have to and that you can get away with comfortably. You avoid dissent where you can avoid it by allowing the kind of carve-outs, the kind of bribes, the kind of avoidances that you need to do so that dissent never becomes widespread enough to foment the sort of horizontal ties that stimulate a proper social movement. Now, if enough people genuinely feel that their lives and liberty are at stake, then that's when the tide turns. That's when you see those horizontal ties, those kind of social movements. And that's when you see a more empathetic sort of response to people who are already suffering from war, you know, like the Ukrainian population, which seems not to have been such a big consideration for a lot of the Russian population so far, who are, I think, for certainly understandable reasons, are concerned with saving their own necks to a large extent. And if it still becomes, if it still remains possible for enough people to save their own necks, then little will change in the medium term. And that is I think that's something we have to bear in mind, right? Because, you know, you asked a question earlier about whether or not this is a response to the need for personnel at the front. And always the need for personnel at the front has got to be balanced in the Kremlin mind with the need to maintain order at home. And we know that Putin almost fetishizes order. So there is never a simple military decision being made from the Russian side in this war. There is always that balance between maintaining order at home and retaining some sort of battlefield performance. So I'm sorry I can't give you a clear answer about where I think that tipping point is, but I would say I don't think that the Kremlin's unaware of that's what it's dealing with. And I think it's very high up on the Kremlin agenda to avoid tipping that point.
That's a great answer, Precious. Thanks very much. And thanks for the questions, Charles. I'm just going to make one comment before wrapping it up. You talked about a tipping point. Charles, you asked about the breaking point. In some other Russia, some other way that Russia could have developed, maybe the question would be whether Vladimir Karamurza's sentence was the breaking point. Unfortunately, clearly that's not the case in the Russia that exists today. On that note, not very happy note, I'll wrap it up here. Precious, thanks very much for joining me and for your great insights and answers.
Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Precious Chatterjee Doody, a lecturer in politics and international studies at Open University in the UK, and an expert on Russian foreign and security policy, as well as its information politics and propaganda. She co-authored the book Russia Today and Conspiracy Theories, People, Power, and Politics on RT, which was published just last year. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on any platform that you choose to listen to podcasts. And I'll be back next Monday for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your questions.